Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you,
I bow to all of you,
free my life from all obstacles,
free my life from all obstacles,
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
That there is a way to disconnect the clock, and there wasn't, but when I looked on it and it said the manufacturer was Hamilton. Yeah. Every time it rings, we'll remember Mother then. Let's begin with the energization exercise, putting both feet flat on the ground, beginning with the left foot, creating tension in it on a low level, in other words, just slightly tensing the muscles, medium, then high, contracting them all the way, and then releasing them, all the muscles. And as you release, try to tune in to the medulla, feeling the life energy flow down through the nervous system and charge that part of your body. Going to the right foot, low, medium, high. Release and feel. Your left calf. It's an excellent way to increase your concentration as you concentrate on those muscles in particular. And you concentrate on creating a low, medium, high. Release and feel your right calf, low, release and feel your left thigh, release and feel your right thigh. Release and feel. Remember, you're sensing, reaching your mind out to sense that tingling vibrancy of the life energy. Left buttocks. Release and feel. Right buttocks. Release and feel. Lower abdomen. This is a tricky one to get concentrated on. It's a good one though. Release and feel. Upper stomach. Release and feel. Left forearm. Release and feel. Right forearm. Release and feel the life energy flowing down to the right forearm area. Left upper arm. Bicep area. Trying to concentrate on those muscles in particular. Release and feel. Right upper arm. then feel your left chest, the pectoral muscles. Release. Feel the flood of life energy. Right chest. Release and feel. Left neck. Release and feel. Right neck. Release and feel. Throat area. Release and feel along the spine and the neck, back of the neck. Release and feel the flood of life energy come into that area. Now we're going to go quickly up through the 20 parts, only this time you're going to retain the tension in each part as we work up. Left foot. Low, medium, high, right, left calf, right, left thigh, right, left buttocks, right, lower abdomen, upper stomach, left forearm, right, left upper arm, right, left chest, right, left neck, right, throat, back of the neck. Now vibrate all 20 parts, letting your slightly shake as you create tension throughout your body, holding it, holding it. Release. And feel the flood of life energy coming down through your body. And even beyond your body, filling up the auric field, that electromagnetic field, all around you, about arm's length, radiating with a beautiful golden light. Exuding health, vitality, fully awake, fully ready. You literally have a constant flow. Remaining open is the key, not contracting. And having done the energization, we can then enter into meditation. First comes concentration. Concentration is concentrating on the breath, on the ajna, the third eye point between the eyebrows, and the mantra, Hong Sa. Not controlling the breath, but simply observing it. It will naturally slow down, the breath will, as you think on it and as you apply Hong Sa, Hong with each incoming breath for the full length of the breath. If there's a natural pause, that's all right. And then watching the breath go out and repeating the name Sa. Hong Sa. If in your practice your breath becomes completely still, there's nothing to worry about. Enter into that stillness, that calmness. You think of the restless tide that the breath always is, along with the mind. To be able to command the waves of your mind and the ebb and flow of your breath, to come into a state of stillness and feel the tremendous peace. Peace that surpasses all understanding. It's not just thinking about peace. It becomes a state of consciousness. Also think down along the spine and opening it to that tremendous vital life energy. Become master of your breath, master of your mind. Descartes actually had it backwards. He said, I think, therefore I am. The yogi says, I am. And out of that comes thought. Drawing yourself back into that original state. With each breath, you're affirming, I am Aum Sa. Thank you. to end your formal meditation, create a transition for yourself. Take a little deeper breath. You can open your eyes halfway with your attention remaining on the ajna. You can wiggle your fingers and your toes. Taking another deeper breath. Mother reminding us that she's still here. So, any questions, thoughts, observations about practice? I assume you've all practiced today, the energization, the hongsa.
David, I have some muscles I just
don't respond.
Yeah, I just can't reach them or whatever. But it really helped yesterday to know that we can do it mentally as well.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
It's very good to connect with different parts of your body. There's different reasons why. We may have some physical malady that prevents us from being able to connect with a part of the body. And as you say, to willfully, mentally connect with it is very good. That begins to connect you to that part of your body. And the subtle life force, even though we may have an injury, behind all injuries, the healing is really the life force that goes into it. So that life force operates through a million different biochemical relationships and cellular actions and so forth. That's all life energy. Withdraw the life energy, all of that cellular action stops. Your blood stops, your lymphatic system stops, everything does. So by drawing your attention to it, even mentally, sending life energy begins the healing process. There can also be psychological and emotional reasons why some parts of our body are difficult to connect with. And once again, that's the beginning of healing, is to consciously move into that. And because the body is a repository of memory of different experiences, particularly traumas and unresolved emotional issues, that can be a reason why the body doesn't respond in the particular areas. Again, really excellent practice to get in there, start moving the life energy. It may trigger some emotions, and that's all right. That's all right. Just simply allow the emotions to move through, the whatever connection, whatever associations might be there. If there's been an injury there, it's natural when we have an injury of the body to push that away. If there's a part of our body that's in pain, to push that away, that's a natural tendency of the mind. So we're going against that. We're doing the opposite of that. And we're drawing our attention right to that place. It's really good, really good. Because through that and releasing our fear, our anger, whatever may be locked up in that part of our body, that will eventually create a physical problem if there's not already. And to redirect the life energy there starts the healing physically, emotionally, mentally. So it's really wonderful, and we're designed to have full use of our body. And even though we may be having difficulty with the body, never take that as a finality. People will think, and you hear medical professionals, well, they'll give you a sentence. You're just going to have to get used to it. That's just the way your life is. I don't accept that. I don't think any of us should accept that. We keep working on that on that area with life energy, and it will begin to move. And it's how miracles happen. Jesus had complete control of his life energy, was able to awaken that life energy in others. And as a result, there were spontaneous healings. Sometimes there's slow healing. So it depends on how receptive we are in combination with what kind of karma we have with that. So sometimes things are more stubborn, sometimes they're more amenable to to responding to the life energy. In either case, we keep at it until we get full success. We never accept it's something. We're all made in the image and the likeness of God. That means we, in our essence, are perfect. We have perfect health. We have perfect mental health. We have perfect emotional health. It's why it's a rub on us to have difficulties. It goes against that intuitional knowledge that we really are perfect. And so we keep striving for that. And even if we have a malady that takes us unto the death of this body, to hold on to that idea of perfection until the very last breath, that's what we take with us then, is the idea of perfection. And we can leave behind the karma and the difficulties that this body has. It's so easy when this body is in pain or having some difficulty to think, that's it. That's who I am. That's how this body is. It'll never be different. You know, when we get a bad cold or a flu or some kind of other sickness, we can't even almost remember what it was like to be healthy, even though it was just the previous day or just a few hours before. We were feeling perfectly fine. That's how quick it changes. So to never accept any imperfection as a finality, it's just something we have to move through in that moment. It's a result of things that we have done before, remembered or unremembered. But it's not the truth of our being.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So kind of going along with that, if we have an area that isn't one of those specific ones that we do in the exercise.
We can tense and relax that area. It can be an organ of your body. It can be your knees, your ankles, something that's in between the spots. And you can work specifically on that spot by creating tension there. If it creates pain, just try to create enough tension short of creating pain there, additional pain to what you already have. And then send that there and use an addition, just being surrounded with this golden light. When you see life energy in its purity through the eye of intuition, it is gold. And so to see that area just flooded with that golden light, with that life energy, and starting to move as if it feels all bound up, if it feels bound up with pain, or if it feels like the muscles are all bound up or not operating correctly, just see that life energy moving in and beginning to activate the cells, the muscles, the tendons, whatever is in that area. Begin to see it operating smoothly, perfectly, without difficulty, without restriction. And you can go a long, long ways towards healing that area. The law of cause and effect reaches back through time. And there's never been a malady, there's never been anything that I've been affected by that I could not trace it back to some origin. Now, we don't always know why a particular thing is happening. And we can say to ourselves, well, I'm getting older, or I had this injury, or I had this event happen to me. Those are all temporary. It may be true that there's a cause and effect in a short term, but it's not the deeper reason. There's a reason why something happened. And we don't even have to know the origin of it. God may show us what the origin was. But we can work on resolving that right in this moment and starting to change it. And we do it on the most fundamental level, which is the life energy. But in yoga, it's called prana. Master called it life energy, and he called these fine particles of life energy, lifetrons. You know, you have electrons, you have protons, you have neutrons. These are lifetrons. And it's that tingling, vibrant energy. Yeah, so we can work on any part of the body, including internal organs, anything at all. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Thoughts, observations, questions? Either the Hangsa or the recharging exercises.
Can I just say something else, mm-hmm. David? So I was thinking today the prana is probably trying to reach all our cells all the time. And is it probably our own constrictions that are stopping it from...
Exactly right. There's blockages. It's the same principle as in Chinese medicine as the qi. And when we have radiant health, it flows easily and naturally to all parts of the body. If we have a body that has some disease or some difficulty to it, there's a lack of flow of that life energy there.
And that's mental attitudes as well.
It can be. There's a lot of different things that can go into why it's not. It can be something that we've done. It can be a thought, a mental attitude. It can be emotional blockage. Mm-hmm. Just think of a time when you've been extremely afraid or nervous or anxious, how contracted you get. And you stop breathing. That's one of the first things. That's why breath, body, and spirit are all connected. You constrict your breath. At the very same time, you're constricting your life energy. We want to do just the opposite. So that when things are difficult, when they're strenuous, we want it such a habit that the automatic response is not to constrict, but to expand. But try it. It's not always so easy because it's an unconscious reaction. There's a fight and flight. Psychologists talk about, and I've added to that, freeze. And it's the deer who's walking through the woods, sees a wolf. What does the deer do? It could run away. It's not likely to fight, but it can freeze. I'm not going to move, not even an eyeball. And maybe the wolf won't see me and will just pass right on by. And that can happen. We're in grade school. Something embarrassing happens, a teacher embarrasses, or another child embarrasses, we freeze. And we can stay frozen our entire life, not breathing properly, not being comfortable being in this world. And it has its effect. To learn to breathe, to learn to be in this world, to allow your life energy to flow evenly, smoothly, powerfully, to have your light expand beyond your body and fill up your auric field. Isn't that wonderful? It's how we're designed to be. And whatever's happened in our life, we can reverse anything that inhibits that life energy. We can begin today. Any other thoughts, questions, observations, either about recharging or about Hangsa? Kathy?
When you're in the state of recharging, or if you're doing Hangsa, whatever, if you...
They're two very different things, but go ahead.
I understand. But if you are in that state, in your attention, becomes focused on your teacher or someone that there's this great devotion to.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of this, I'll use the word technique, but these things that you have been practicing, they are dissipated. And so then your whole attention comes to that one. Yeah. And it's that one which you're really after.
Sure. Sure. That takes you beyond technique. And it merges you into a pure state of being. Pure state of being entails no technique. All of the yogis, and for that matter, all spiritual teachers down through time, when the Buddha first achieved enlightenment, he had striven for so many years to get there, and then finally he achieved that. And so he was in this state of enlightenment, and his natural compassion thought of other people, a suffering world. And he thought, how can I help this world? How can I convey to others what I now experience, what I now know? And he thought, there's no way. It's such an exponential leap in consciousness from where I was to where I am now. I don't see any possibility. But his compassion remained. And he, of course, he had a brilliant mind, and he began to think on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and it all unfolded. And it was a means to help people to get from there to here. Now, some people obviously could follow the way better than other people could. And so people got results, others didn't. What can he do? He can give the truth as he knows it. He can teach it, the highest, purest truth that he knew, convey that. And there will be some who will be able to take that truth and go the whole way. Some will go part of the way. Some will just tread water. Some will go backwards. But he did what he could do. And so all techniques are meant to be passageways to pass from where you are to where we would like to be. Intuitively, we know we would like to be there. But the technique itself is not the end goal. It's a means for attaining something else. And if you'll remember from the autobiography of a yogi, Ram Gopal Mazumdar told Master, he says, you love meditating, but never forget, meditation is not the goal. Attaining high state of consciousness, transcendence, that's the goal. Sat Chit Ananda. Sat is pure state of being. Chit is pure consciousness and awareness. Ananda is pure bliss. That is your goal. So it's wonderful to meditate. It's the means that have been devised for us to help us to get to where the great ones would like us to be. But the technique is not an end in itself. So you sit for 20, 30 minutes, 60 minutes in the morning. Okay, I've done my meditation. Now I'm up, check that one off the list of to-do things today. And of course, we need to develop habits, but that's not the goal. The goal is not to meditate for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 60 minutes. The goal is to live in Sat Chit Ananda. Master vowed to himself, I will not give up from meditation until I have tasted God. That was his vow. And it's a good one. And what it puts in front of us is, what is the goal here? Do I experience peace? Do I experience joy? Do I experience Sat Chit Ananda?
So if I expound a little bit on, I think it was Jerry, where certain muscles or certain parts of the 20 parts, later on during the day, as I'm moving through the day, it feels like it's dot, dash, dot, dash, and the dots are like, skip this part. How would you keep working? What would you keep doing in those areas that are tight and in resistance or doing their healing?
That's exactly the part you really want to spend some extra attention on. However, it's not a thing of force. So I'm not gonna tense that harder because it hurts more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to sense. Here's the thing that Papa taught me when I was at the ashram. I was very, very sick the first time I was there. I was running a high fever. I was in a lot of physical pain. And spent days in my own room without leaving it. And at some point I thought, Papa, you tell me that pain and bliss are the same. That's what he taught. Pain and the bliss are the same. Now, it's a little different from the Gita. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says pleasure and pain are the same to the yogi. But Papa said pain and bliss are the same. I said, I don't feel that way right now. I'm in a lot of pain, but I don't get the bliss. And so I carried on this internal conversation with Papa, and suddenly in my ajna, I saw Papa there. And he had a toothless grin, and he held out his hands, and I took his hands, and we started dancing around in a circle with Om Shri Ram, and I felt bliss. Now, my body was still in pain, but I felt bliss. And I realized the very same life energy that carries pain from some part of my body to my brain is the same life energy that carries bliss. It's not different. And when I look to the life energy that must be encapsulated within pain, it changes it. It feels differently to me. It's not just simply pain any longer, it's life energy. And behind the life energy is vitality and is ultimately bliss. When I unlock that code, it changes so that pain and bliss are the same.
So that part of I am not my body.
It's not just simply an idea. It has to be an experience. We look to some part of your body that's in pain.
Mm-hmm.
Sense the life energy that's carrying that pain sensation from that part of your body to your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it as life energy, not just pain. There's a lot of life energy, isn't there, in pain.
Okay.
A lot of life energy. It's
mm-hmm.
powerful.
Yep.
So you sense the life energy in there. What do you sense as you sense that as life energy and not just pain?
If I...
Just in this moment.
Just in this moment, it's the focus of the mind going into the pain rather than being in the life energy and experiencing the life energy, which is the bliss.
Okay.
But so taking a sidestep and going, oh, this is pain, and moving more into that.
Right, because that's how your mind is conditioned to think of it. This is pain, I don't like pain, I don't want pain, and so on. And what does that mean? It means there's something wrong with my body. It has a whole story around it, doesn't it? This is letting go of the story.
So if I turn the page,
okay,
or zip ahead to it,
okay,
and the next paragraph, and move back to this is life force.
Yes. What do you experience just in this moment?
It's like a shift. It's like a little nudge of wind that goes and blows you back on.
Okay.
Of course.
And what do you experience then?
It softens and loosens,
yeah,
and moves through.
Yes. That's right.
Okay.
Just imagine being able to stay with that, working with it. And you can see the mind's tendency to switch back to the story.
Yeah, I want to go back to the story.
So you let go of the story. Just tune right into where you know it's powerful life energy because it's powerful in your body. And you sense that power, you sense that life energy.
It's like the two ends get put back together and the circuit continues.
Yeah.
So it's just that distraction where the circuit gets broken. And as soon as you reconnect it, you're back in the loop again.
That's right. That's right. We all experience pain in the body, huh?
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing that we all have in common. Lhari Mahasaya used to say, this body is nothing but a nest of troubles. And in many ways it is, and we feel betrayed by the body. And the reason we feel betrayed is because our natural state is a state of perfect health. But because we've entered into this life, we make mistakes, we have thinking errors, we have errors of speech, we have errors of action. It all has a natural consequence and results in something. And oftentimes, most times, we know we're doing something wrong when we do it. Doesn't stop us from doing it. I want what I want in that moment, huh? And we charge forward. Oh, but that has meaning to it. It has consequences to it.
I haven't heard it put that way. I was always, if there's any identity on the body, then the body's like feeling like that God betrayed it somehow.
Mm.
You know, that's like the flip side of what you said.
Mm-hmm.
It still creates issues.
Mm-hmm. It can. We certainly have experience of that. But it's not how we're naturally made. We're naturally made in that image and likeness of God. That's how we're meant to function and how far we get away from that.
Mm-hmm. I just think it's interesting that the programming can be the reverse of what the reality is.
Yeah. Yes, oh, it's the difficulty, isn't it? It's that all of our programming, what the world tells us. We're meant to be free. Okay. When I first met Mother, it was in March of 1974, and I had read some things, some literature about Eastern teachings, but not really very familiar with guru-disciple relationship. And as Westerners in particular, I think we like our freedom. Huh? We like, oh, I'm my own person. And the idea of kind of going along with somebody else as long as I choose to, then that's all right. So what is guru-disciple relationship? I'll read to you a little bit from Master's description, the autobiography of the yogi, the Christ-like life of Lhari Mahasaya. Thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness. In these words to John the Baptist, and in asking John to baptize him, Jesus was acknowledging the divine rights of his guru. From a reverent study of the Bible from an Oriental viewpoint, and from intuitional perception, I am convinced that John the Baptist was, in past lives, the guru of Christ. There are numerous passages in the Bible which infer that John and Jesus in their last incarnations were, respectively, Elijah and his disciple, Elisha. These are the spellings in the Old Testament. The Greek translators spelled the names as Elias and Elishas. They reappear in the New Testament in these changed forms. the very end of the Old Testament is a prediction of the reincarnation of Elijah and Elisha. Behold, I will send you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Thus John, Elijah, sent before the coming of the Lord, was born slightly earlier to serve as a herald for Christ. An angel appeared to Zacharias, the father, to testify that his coming son, John, would be no other than Elijah or Elias. But the angel said unto him, Fear not, Zacharias, for thy prayer is heard, and thy wife Elizabeth shall bear thee a son, and thou shalt call his name John. And many of the children of Israel shall turn to their Lord their God, and he shall go before him in the spirit and the power of Elias, or Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. Jesus twice, unequivocally, identified Elijah or Elias as John. Elias has come already, and they knew him not. Then the disciples understood that he spake to them of John the Baptist. And again Christ says, For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John, and if you will receive it, this is Elijah, Elias, which was for to come. When John denied that he was Elijah, he meant that in the humble garb of John, he no longer was in the outward elevation of Elijah, the great guru. In his former incarnation, he had given the mantle of his glory and his spiritual wealth to his disciple, Elisha. And Elisha said, I pray to thee, let a double portion of thy spirit come upon me. And he said, Thou hast asked a very hard thing. Nevertheless, if thou see me when I am taken from thee, it shall be so unto thee. And he took the mantle of Elijah that fell from him. The roles become reversed. Elijah John was no longer needed to be the ostensible guru of Elisha Jesus, now perfected in divine realization. When Christ was transfigured on the mountain, it was his guru, Elias, with Moses, whom he saw. Again, in his hour of extremity on the cross, Jesus cried out the name Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. That is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Some of them that stood there, when they heard that, said, This man calleth for Elias. Let us see whether Elias will come to save him. The eternal bond of guru and disciple that existed between John and Jesus was present also for Babaji and Lori Mahasya. With tender solicitude, the deathless guru swam the Lethean waters that swirled between the last two lives of his chela and guided the successive steps taken by the child and then by the man Lori Mahasya. It was not until the disciple reached his 33rd year that Babaji deemed the time to be ripe to openly reestablish the never-severed link. And so we read about this, and in the West we don't get so much of the guru-disciple relationship. In the East you see it manifest quite often. What it means is that the guru is one who has attained a state of realization. Meher Baba said that when you attain mastery on the fifth level, as we know from last night, is the throat chakra, the fifth chakra there, that one has the ability then to guide others as a guru. And really, as that one ascends all the way into God consciousness, this becomes the way that it's one spiritual master can help another to be released in this life. If they have not attained self-realization, if they have not gone the way of the cross and the Christ, then they can in no way take another individual all the way unto God consciousness. It takes one to be able to do that. God uses that one in order to transfer the life energy, the light, the consciousness that can awaken one who is seeking that awakening in themselves. It is not an ordinary relationship, and it is not always easily understood. Master writes beautifully in the autobiography of a yogi of his relationship with Sri Yukteswar. But in truth, the relationship between guru and disciple takes many, many different forms. Mother talked about one disciple who came to her for Kriya initiation, and she just needed that one touch from Mother, and she was on her way, and she didn't need anything else from Mother but that one touch. It was an awakening touch, and she was ready, she was ripe. Mother was initiated by her guru, Yoganandaji. When she met Master, she stood in line after he gave a talk, and when she came up and he was shaking hands with everybody who had come that night to hear him speak, and when she looked into his eyes, she felt an electrical bolt of lightning, as it were, go right through her ajna, her forehead, and went throughout her entire being. And she would say, when telling about that, that from that moment to this, I was his. And she accepted him in that moment. But it was a long transition time, because Mother had come into this world already an enlightened being, but she came in a state of ignorance, and this is oftentimes the case for great what are called avatars, those who have already attained perfection in a previous life. They come for a specific purpose. They come in order to really help to change this world in significant ways. Their names may not be household names and recognized everywhere, but they do a tremendous work. Some are well known, some are not, and many are not. Many go about their lives with quiet dignity, and the world knows them not, and yet the world is transformed and changed because they have been here. And so when you meet the guru, there's something inside of you that says yes to them, that is awakened by their words, by their consciousness, by something within them that changes you, awakens you, and brings you into a new state of being. When I first met Mother, I heard her talk, and she spoke with such power. And that power, I felt my hair was long in those days, and I felt like my hair could be flying straight back. It just was like a great spiritual wind in the room. And I listened to her, and she spoke about God, and I wasn't on that good of terms with God at the time. And so, I wasn't used to hearing that name, and if I did hear it, I was usually looking for the quickest exit. But somehow, the way that Mother said it, it was different. And she talked about Christ consciousness, and I'd never heard that before. But there's something in her, her presentation, her consciousness, her energy, that made me know that this was not an ordinary person. It wasn't until she stood at the back of the room and she gave everyone there a hug on their way out. And I stood waiting in line, and as I got closer, my heart started pounding so hard, I thought my heart would just come right out of my chest, and I didn't understand it, why I was having that kind of reaction. And when she gave me a hug, just the next thing I remember, I'm in the back seat of the car that I came in. And I had come with these friends, and Mother apparently had spoken about renunciation that night. And they thought, in good fun, they thought they would start their life of renunciation by stopping off at Baskin and Robbins ice cream on the way home and having a little bit of ice cream. And I remember them talking about that, and it was as if I was looking at them through a telescope 1,000 miles away. And I realized that I was really first aware at that moment, since the moment I had hugged Mother, something tremendous had happened. I didn't understand it. I didn't know what that was. The mind couldn't catch up to it all. But I knew something profound had happened. And I thought, I want to get to the bottom of whatever that is. And as the years have unfolded, just as I think I'm getting to the bottom of something, the bottom opens up into a much vaster universe than I ever suspected before. And it's gone on like that. And that's the way that it is. You think that you get to some point and it's all the end of everything. Now you know everything. But it's not like that exactly. What you get established in is in your oneness with God. That feeling, that awareness of being in tune with God, of feeling God, is now continuous. But God loves to show you his never-ending creation. And if the creation runs out of surprises, then you enter into the pure state of his being. And that has surprise after surprise. Sometimes we think we enter into the pure state of being, and that's the end of everything. But God, who is the source of everything that is, by whatever name you wish to call him, as Shakespeare said, a rose by any other name is still a rose. Call it God, call it Nirvana, call it Samadhi, it's all the same. And you enter into that state, and you enter into the very core of life. You think of all the intelligence that has gone into creating just this one earth. And this one earth is just one of billions and trillions of earths spread out throughout the universe. And you think of all that intelligence, all that power. And when you go to God, you go to the source of all of that. All of that, what the sun is, what the earth is, what the solar system is, just a tiny, minuscule aspect of that divine consciousness. How can we possibly think that's the end of things? It's the source of everything. It's the source of who we are. It's the source from which everything else is sprung. It's the most exciting. It's the most powerful. It's the most moving. Because God represents the best of everything that is. At one point, Krishna is talking to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, and he starts listing the best of everything in creation, the best of the trees, the best of the mountains, the best of the flowers, everything. He says, this is God. It's the cream of creation. And I am that. Anything else is a distortion, and it's a temporary thing that happens, but it has no permanency. It has no truth to it. Pain, sickness, ignorance, anger, all of these things, they're temporary aberrations and have no permanency to them whatsoever. Every single aspect of creation will eventually be withdrawn into the divine being. There's nothing that is left out. Nothing that is left behind. How can it be? It is all part and parcel of the one divine consciousness. And you are that in your essence. In your truest reality. And yet we walk upon the earth, we think of ourselves as simply a limited human being. Perhaps we live with shame. Perhaps we live with anger. Perhaps we live with disease. And we think this is the finality. No way. No way is that possible. And so the Guru comes to awaken us to that greater possibility. Every time I would come to see Mother and she would give a talk, will it be the same, I would think? Will I feel uplifted? Will I feel that divine power inside of her? Will I feel that transformation? And I did every time, but I tested her every single time. I wasn't an easy sell. And even after 2 years and practicing Kriya, I finally went through a thought process, because I thought, what if none of this is true? What if none of this is true? What if I'm following some false thing here? And I thought, okay, what if it isn't true? Would I regret living my life the way that I live it now? Practicing Kriya Yoga, chanting God's name, always being with God, and to the greatest degree that I could possibly do. And I thought, I wouldn't live my life another way at all. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind. I'm perfectly happy the way that I am. And if that were to come at my last breath, then I would realize that I had lived in error all my life. I would not regret it at all, because I lived according to the highest light that I knew. Now, I have never come to that point where I thought I'm following after something that's false. It's only confirmed deeper and deeper and deeper in me through time and years that what Mother taught is the truth. And even things that I put on the back burner at the time, she said, and I said, well, I don't know. I don't know. And this is the wonderful thing about this path. It's not just an article of belief. Belief is sometimes where we begin, but it's really coming into a state of realization. And realization means that you realize it with every particle of your being. There is no doubting Thomas left inside of you. And so Mother came to awaken that in me. And this is the role of a guru, to teach you the truth, to awaken that divine consciousness within you, and to root you on so that you might realize that tremendous truth in yourself that they have realized themselves. And so this is the role of the guru, teach you the methods, to teach you the truth as they have realized it, and then to pass that on into your mind, into your being, not to brainwash you, not to make you a blind follower. What good is that? That's a weak person. I oftentimes thought with the people who came to Mother, they're all strong personalities. And they're all really different kinds of personalities. This is not about forming everyone into a common mold to reduce their sense of self, but it's rather to expand, to become the person that God designed you to be, to fulfill the destiny that you've come into this earth to be. And if it were not that, it would be something far, far less. Nothing that I wanted anything to do with. And I always felt that Mother held out my highest and my best interest, even when it was difficult at times, oftentimes. But we're in the business of transformation, huh? And transformation is not an easy thing. It's something we have to dedicate ourselves to and really go to work on if we're going to make the progress that will satisfy us in the end. So with that in mind, let us take a break before anybody's bladder bursts, and we'll come back. Reverend Jill to take up something that she mentioned last night, which was around expansion and contraction. An important topic as we think about life energy and expansion of consciousness.
We've gone anyone's got anything new for me. The people who know me know that, or some of them know that I've just started a new job, and so it started about 8 days ago. I went from barely working 8 hours a week to now I'm about 48 hours a week so far this week. And today in particular was very hectic and frantic, and I quite honestly didn't think about being connected to God after my meditation until I went to the bathroom and sat down. And I thought, oh, I'm supposed to check in with God. I thought, I could share that, but that won't help the men in the room very much. Women run to the bathroom a lot. And so I thought, now how do I put my preaching into practice today and make sure that I keep checking in and not contracting? And it was very conscious of feeling like this part of my head and neck were about this tight at different points. And so to just, every time I became conscious of that, to just take a breath. I mean, literally we're always taking breaths, but to just stop. And one image David gave us before and that really connected for me with plugging in my phone every night was to just stop and slow down and open that space and imagine that I'm literally putting myself into God the charger. And the way my cell phone works is, you know, the charging base is right at the bottom and it sits up nice and straight, and there's that spot that the charging cable goes into. And so I imagine myself as my cell phone and God as my current, and just plugging into that and letting it start to flow in and through me. And instead of feeling like I'm going through the day like this, I start to slowly relax and expand, and everything gets softer and gentler and less contracted. And the other thing is that I find that things flow better, you know, when you're in that open, receptive space. You can receive other people's help, you can be more open to possibilities. Literally, when adrenaline goes through us and we contract, we're set up as animals to, when adrenaline's in our system, for our choices to be narrowed. Because if we saw all the choices that we have in the world, it's hard to make a quick decision. So as adrenaline rushes through you, your brain starts to narrow your field of vision so that you get to kind of black and white choices. I can only do this, I can only do that. So if we are able to breathe and relax and consciously soften ourselves and open ourselves to the life force, it also just makes our lives run more smoothly because we stay open to all the possibilities. And if you think about when you got here today, try and put yourself back into that moment when you arrived. Maybe the traffic was bad, maybe you had a beautiful walk before. Everybody came from kind of different times and spaces. And what did your body feel like? And was it in a state of peacefulness and receptivity, or was it tight and tensed from the day you might have experienced? Greg and I got in the car. My husband, for those of you who don't know us, is here too. And we both had really hectic days at work. And I said, and I parked the car and left it running and jumped in the passenger seat. And he's like, no, I wanted you to drive so I could get ready for Kriya. And I'm like, no, I need you to drive so I can get ready for Kriya. And so we both had come in that frantic space, but also knew that kind of wonderful feeling of being ready to receive, getting to a meditation class and being ready to receive that, and how much more you can get rather than I think that's another thing that David's talked about, is if you're like this, you can't receive anything. If you are like this, you're open to receiving. So your hands are open, your body's open, your mind and heart are open. And that's that expansive sense. I guess that's what I would invite you to, if nothing else, if you take away nothing else from the evening, is to, when you return and as the evening goes on, to try and just soften and open yourself. Because contraction just keeps everything away. It feels like, and David has told us this many times, it feels like when we're afraid that our best defense is this, right? Is to hunker down, to isolate, to tighten. And indeed, you know, that's a posture that if somebody's going to punch you, you might survive. But in the long run, you're isolated and you're alone. If you can open to God and to everything that's around you, then you aren't just your own being. You're in contact with everything. And think about how much more powerful you are and how you're not a victim, you're not alone. You're filled with that spirit of God. Maybe that repulses the negative, maybe it brings the positive around you so that you're safer. But you just, that expansion only brings good, it only brings abundance. It doesn't add to your lack of safety.
Do you have any questions about expansion, contraction? Do you understand what those terms mean?
I use for expansion, letting go. Mm-hmm. Feels the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would, in my language, you'd be letting go of the contraction.
Yeah.
Fear, you know, makes us contract. Huh? Love makes us expand.
I was just going to say that when we did the energization exercise and you added in the part about, you know, feeling the energy flood and then feeling it expand out, and I really felt that this time, and I don't remember feeling that so clearly before. So in the past I've had trouble with that expanding the energy. Out and out, and you know, there's some place where I just
stops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it felt really nice to, to just feel it. It went out more than an arm's length, I think.
Can get as big as the universe, even more.
I know, that's what you tell us.
Wondering about expansiveness. I often picture people who are able to be very sort of physically large in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that's a different expression of the expansiveness that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Can I?
There's, yeah, go ahead.
It was interesting when I was sitting there trying to think about what I was going to talk about, and anybody who's on my Facebook, I put up a picture from when I was 19 and wanted to be a rock star this week. Because that was my first touch of wanting God. It was that feeling. And I'm still a pretty big personality, but I used to be a lot bigger personality, fair to say. And I, you know, if I wasn't attracting attention to myself, I was not happy. And I think I was trying to feel that of being big in the world, and yet I felt very afraid and very tight. And I was thinking about that when I was thinking about talking about expansion and contraction, how I was trying to get that by spreading out to everybody. But in fact, I felt very small and very tight and not very supported and not very open. But I would have looked open to everybody, you know. And I would tell everybody everything about anything that had happened to me or any. And but I didn't feel expanded. And that's, I think, what I was looking for, so.
Mm-hmm. And certainly the ego can get a certain amount of magnetism and expansiveness, and it's pure ego. That's its sense of, aren't I wonderful? Aren't I great? And in the basic relationship, one of the things that I like about relationship with God is we are always in a subservient role, not in a negative kind of way, like I'm, Papa calls himself the slave of God. And you know, you think, well, who wants to be a slave? You know, nobody does. You have to understand what he means by that. And to be that instrument, as I talked about last night, to be that fine writing utensil, pen in God's hand as he writes in the book of life, and how joyous that is and wonderful. You don't get that with any ego expansion. You don't get that sense of bliss. You don't get that sense of peace and joy and light. It's something else. It's power. It's expansion in that sense. But you don't get the qualities of the divine consciousness. And that's how we can recognize. Because there are times when the ego can get aggrandized. We get acknowledgement in this world. We have things that perhaps people project things onto us, and it feels great, and you feel expansive. And we see that with politicians and others who can have that large magnetic kind of draw, but it's not a draw to God. It's not a draw to the supreme consciousness. It's something less than. So to know it by its qualities, do we have peace? Do we have joy? Is there light? And as long as we have a sense of ego that's separate from God, we ascribe what we get as coming from God. If we have anything good at all, that comes from God. And that gives us a right relationship with the divine consciousness. Once we merge into divine consciousness and ego is no longer there, Master one time said, you can't have Yogananda God consciousness. You can only have your own God consciousness. Besides, I killed that fellow a long time ago. He surrendered himself so completely and so perfectly into God consciousness that in all essence, the individuality of Yogananda, as he thought of himself as a separate being, disappeared. Now, even from our viewpoint of listening to Master's talks, listening to his singing, he sings with a full heart. He's a wonderful big personality. Mother is a wonderful big personality. But it was totally God-focused. And it takes you to a different place in receiving them, in thinking on them, in interacting with them. One time I was thinking, God realized individuals are like a doorway to God. Other individuals may represent that themselves as that. But if they've not attained that state of consciousness, they're a closed door. You come up and what you meet is an ego personality. With a God personality, you approach the individual and the door swings open and you merge into divine consciousness. That's a huge difference. So I think when we meet people who have large personalities, they take up a lot of space. That can be wonderful. God takes up a lot of space. But where does it take us to, being around them? Where does it take us to in ourselves? Does it lift us up? Does it bring us down? Where in our own consciousness? And that will help indicate where that individual is coming from. And when we feel and begin to recognize what that pulsation of God feels like, we can instantly realize it. Mother one time talked about going to a small store out in Duval. And I think it was she and her daughter were just out taking a ride one day, and they stopped at this store, and she was looking. It was, I think it was all kinds of used things that were in the store. And she was looking around and looking around, and finally, I don't know if she found something, but she went up to the counter. It was a glass counter. And she looked up, and she saw the individual on the other side of this counter. She looked into his eyes, and she felt God. This was a tremendous soul. And it was the two tremendous souls connecting, and they just recognized each other in a moment, in a flash. And it was wonderful. It was beautiful. Master used to sing the laurels of one individual, and what a great God-realized individual he was. So some disciples went to see him one time. And he lived in a disheveled house, and he was kind of a fat person, and his clothes were sloppy. And they were shocked. You know, this is a highly realized being. Look at how he's living, you know. Look at what his body looks like. And yet Master recognized something tremendous in him. So when we meet somebody who has that higher consciousness awakened in them, and we've had some sense of it, then we feel that in ourselves. It lifts us up to a new place. And it tells us, whereas another person, and they may be a very good person trying to do good things, but it's pure ego. Still. It's not that that's negative and that they're trying to do something evil or anything like that, but it's pure ego. It's somebody who's trying to do good in this world. It's different for the God-realized person. They're not trying to do good. They're just simply manifesting what's already inside of them. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Yeah. And magnetism doesn't necessarily mean somebody is realized. And not having magnetism doesn't necessarily mean they're not realized. There are some very great souls who live in obscurity in this world. But they live in that perfect sense of consciousness. We sometimes think somebody has to be famous or, you know, not. Depends on the work that they've come to do. Somebody once asked me if Mother was famous. And I said, well, to a small group of people, she's very famous. But she could walk through the Bon Marché. It's turned into Macy's now, but it used to be the Bon Marché. People would love her, but they didn't know necessarily who she was as a soul. But they responded to her. Oh, Mrs. Hamilton, so lovely to see you. Others would see her and instantly recognize who she was. And the great saints in India, they would just drop down at her feet.
I was just trying to think. There's this book called The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. And when she was depressed, it felt like a bell jar was over her head and no air was getting in.
Yeah.
And
sometimes I feel like I've got a bit of a bell jar on me. And once I went to see Mother Hamilton, and she took a look at me, and with dispatch, she started massaging my scalp, giving me a good head massage.
Uh-huh.
And when I went outside, all of a sudden, it was like there was no ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing between me and the infinite sky. And it just, it was kind of scary, actually.
Because it's unfamiliar. And it feels exposed.
There's no ceiling.
Yeah. And it's what keeps us oftentimes from expanding. It's the idea it's unfamiliar, we feel exposed. It's out of our safety zone. And it's one of the things in meditation that we can battle with. We can feel completely exposed and open. And oh, can we contract in a hurry? Thinking that that's, unconsciously thinking that's our safety, is to contract. But what a price we pay. What a price we pay. One time I was on a university campus, I was a student there. And somehow God just took away all the normal barriers that I carried around with me. Didn't even realize how many barriers. And just took them all away. And what I saw was Mother's image on the chest of everybody that I saw, all the other students walking across campus. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. But it came as grace. And as wonderful it was, I could feel it beginning to reverse. And all the barriers started to come against my own will. I didn't want them to. But I had erected them. It was going to be my job in life to reverse all of that. And I'd have to work at it and do the job to get there to where I could expand and remain expanded. And what we realized was before felt like our protection and being contracted, God becomes our protection. The light becomes our protection. And we can remain full, open, exposed. And we've never been safer because we feel that life flowing through us and around us. And so there is no need to be fearful. In fact, we've never been safer, and we feel that light and that protection of God. And then we just drop the idea of contracting. It just doesn't make any sense to us. Why would we? Walk into a room. Think of walking into this room. And the first thing you do, you expand your light out and fill everyone in this room with that light. Now everyone in this room is a friend. There are no strangers. You may never have met them before. But there's not a stranger in the room because your light has gone out and incorporated the entire room in your spirit and in the light of God. Can you imagine going through life without any fear, where you've never met a stranger? Everyone is a friend.
Corliss, that's the first step in getting to that, too. Not letting your head blow off.
But it can be frightening, and sometimes people reverse it because it is, because it's sudden, and it's unexpected, and we feel exposed. What will happen to me? God always means well.
And if you play with it for a while, it starts to feel very, very comfortable. It feels very startling at first. And then if you allow yourself to go past your body, you know, let that light body spread out, mm-hmm. expand, it becomes so much more comfortable than keeping it all squished in.
Yeah. Our universal spirit is not comfortable inside of this enclosure. So you can work with it. Just gently. Just work with expanding yourself in all situations. You're at the store doing some shopping. Let your spirit and your light just expand out. Nobody needs to know anything. But you're just working with allowing that to expand out and be a blessing to everyone who's there. Why not? Why not? Okay. With that in mind, let us close our eyes, sitting upright, feet on the floor. And just feel that light inside of you. It begins in the heart center. And don't squeeze out. Just gently with every breath, whatever feels comfortable and right to you, you can't force it out. If you try to force it out, it'll contract. But you're in a zone of safety here. And to just let that light expand out with your breath, softly, gently. You can go out arm's length around your body. You can move out and incorporate this room and everyone in it. You can move out into this entire community and seeing the light and the life and the peace and the joy permeating this entire community. You can even move out and incorporate this entire world and see this world as an extension of that light and that life, peace and that joy that's in your heart. And that it permeates this world. It saturates it with love and with peace and light, unbeknownst perhaps to its own self. And in some are easily influenced and recipients of that. And others perhaps not, but all are saturated in it. And then you move out and you see the solar system, the sun and the planets, and you easily expand out to incorporate them. And even in what appears to be the blackness of space is this vibrancy and light. And a light that is seen with the inner eye. And then moving out even further, incorporating galaxies. The universe. Seeing this universe as an island universe amongst other universes. And the vast astral worlds beyond that. And if you dare to incorporate the causal, the ideal worlds, which are even much more vast and light and luminous. There is literally no end. And it's all in peace and light and joy. And you are that. And then you think of being incorporated in just a tiny human body and limited in that. And how cramped that is for your universal spirit. And you reverse and you go back out as expansive as your spirit wishes to be. This is your true home. It's the truth of your being. You can see how small life can contract itself to, but you can also see how immense it can expand into. And the more you work with it, the more easily you can accommodate it. There's just certain limits. You get so far out, and well, that's it. But that can change with time. So you find that you can trust in this. And find your true home in the eternal nature of the divine. With that, I pranam to you, to the divine light within you that is infinite and eternal in nature. And we'll meet again tomorrow. In the meantime, practice, practice, practice. More sadhana.